Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to I Learned to Write by Writing. In this programme, participants in two continuing education creative writing courses share their poetry and creative non-fiction essays. Here's your host, Dr. Elaine Webster, Director of Summer School and Continuing Education at the University of Otago.
Well, it's lovely to be here on Access Radio, celebrating and enjoying some of the work that we've done in the summer with continuing education at University of Otago. We had some wonderful creative writing courses, two of which are represented here with some people who took part in those courses, going to read a little bit of their work for us today, which is fantastic. The two courses that we've got today are from the poetry course that was run by Sue Wootton, who's well-known Dunedin poet, and the essay, creative essay writing and creative non-fiction was run by Lynn Jenner, who's a Wellington writer, academic and poet herself. So she's done a lot of work in essays and is also very experienced in teaching. So we had these two wonderful short courses in January and some truly wonderful writing that came out of that. And we'd like to share some of that with you today. Now, one of those people who took part, Richard Wisniewski, is from Christchurch, and he's not able to be with us today, but he has sent his poem. So one of our participants, John, is going to read that poem for him. So let's start with that.
Richard's poem is Letter to Ralph Houtery. And this morning from Karatani Beach, with the easy roll of the sea, your hill, Houtery's hill, what's left serves as a reminder. Tanakwe, we weren't friends and we didn't know each other. I danced on the periphery of Captain Cook conversations back down in the student years, and today you spoke again from the wall in the Port Library, the wall above the books. So a few lines of gratitude having stood on what's left of your hill. Houtery's Hill, I'll call it. A lone seagull drifted, working the thermals above the cliff face. And amazed I heard how some bugger re-sculpted it, carving a place for man-made toys with huge mandibles. Shifting logs, someone you know called them chopsticks. Ha! Huh. Such derision. And I understand the completeness given the description of your plot. It left me wondering, was it an arbitrary line or sculptured with engineering precision like the Otera Tunnel? Your lines are more poetic. It's a bit like the right whale, someone said, was in the harbour yesterday. Right whale, wrong place. Couldn't resist the dig, as they say. A lone seagull drifted, working the thermals above the cliff face. As some compensation they, whoever they were, created Oputai. In memory to you on what's left of your hill, though on the seaward side. The sculpture's not too flash, really, just interrupts the view. Out to the harbour as a reminder of human folly. Tanak tena rawa atu koe. What a sacrifice, your hill for the harbour, your creative space in exchange for jobs to help the economy. Some would say there's an art in that as well. But whoever they were would most likely not understand the line they took. Life's a bitch at times, but a few beers, pen to paper, a mental readjustment, and sculpt somewhere else. Haere rā. Your visuals remain in the absence of your creative space. Let the re-sculpted hill be your lasting metaphor. Your wishes fulfilled, and this morning from Karatani Beach, with the easy roll of the sea, your hill, Hauteri's Hill, what's left serves as a reminder. And a lone seagull drifted, working the thermals above the cliff face.
Thank you. I'm Elaine. I took part in the course. I really loved the poetry course. I've been writing bits of poetry for a long time, but this was a really beautiful way to learn about how words make patterns. And I loved learning different ways of exploring with those patterns. So what I came up with in the course, I'm going to read to you today. So the first one I'll share is called A Marriage. I remember the dogs and the daisies and the long grass where summer entered its own heart. I remember that you carried the picnic, walking down green avenues to the centre of the world. I remember watching clouds crawl across the afternoon where your face was in my eyes. I remember the smell of sunlit mint mixed with strawberries from the Garden of No Return. I remember driving to central Otago where grass was ash on the hottest day of the year. I remember arguing over road signs caught in the dusty circles of those high roads. I remember a dry stream bed overflowing with blue lupins and the glitter of fool's gold. I remember flat pack furniture, such a big risk on the last day of a tough year. This poem's what's called a pantoon, which is where you play with lines. You have a set of lines and then you repeat them in different patterns through the poem, and you kind of create this rhythm that returns to itself. So it's quite a nice style to play with. This one's called Aramoana. I have been here 100 times. Each time I bring you with me, and the sea will roll in the same, yet something will happen, something else. Each time I bring you with me, like the idea of kelp forests under the sea, yet something will happen, something else, now tangled with sea tulips on the sand. Like the idea of kelp forests under the sea, and the sea will roll in the same, now tangled with sea tulips on the hand, becoming a tent city for migrant gulls. And the sea will roll in the same, each time I bring you with me, now tangled with sea tulips on the sand, yet something will happen, something else. Becoming a tent city for migrant gulls, like the idea of kelp forests under the sea. And the sea will roll in the same. I have been here 100 times. We had this lovely poem that was read to us by one of the people who took part, Anna, and it was a French poet, and I think it was Prévert, who had this wonderful poem called Pour toi, mon amour, which is for you, my love. And it tells a story of love, and then it becomes quite heavy towards the end, you know, where love starts warm and engaged and then ends in chains. And we were sort of invited to riff on that theme, so this is what I came up with. Pour toi, mon amour. I went all the way to Clinton for you, my dear, and plucked you like a flower from a field of puppies. I washed off the smell of history for you, my dear, and let you sleep beside me with your breath in my hair. I made my arms a circle for you, my dear, and you came closer, sighing, like the beginning of something. I opened the door in the morning for you, my dear, and found the dawn awash with song and you watering the ground. I built a small enclosure for you, my dear, so when I go away without you, I will return to find you here. And as you can probably tell, that's about my puppy dog. So anyway, that was a really nice experiment with poetry. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hello, I'm John, and I was a participant in the poetry course that University Extension ran over the recent holidays. The two poems I'm going to read are in a sense related. One's about Dunedin, and the other's about Thomas Bracken. I've called the first poem City of My Dreams. From a world beyond I have come, through fields of pivot and gun, past pylon sentinels by highway and plain, holding close the secrets of these hills. I have no promises to keep, meaningless or deep, as I sunbathe in the octagon, remembering forgotten things. I see a rainbow over Waverley, while Flagstaff waves to me. I walk his streets as Charles saw them. I hear him in the clear. In my end is my beginning. Tomorrow I'll go surfing at St. Clair. Tom Bracken is an iconic Dunedin writer. And my second poem is, in a sense, a tribute to him and his place in our literature. Tom Bracken looks back. Wandering in the northern cemetery, I see that time and distance are not the same, and that distance changes us all in time. Consider Tom, patriot and poet, since celebrated and sung, dying penniless and not understood. Now and for eternity, looking back to Dunedin and the bay.
So we've got two people here reading from the essays course, which is fantastic. And also I'll just take this opportunity as well to say that from Lynn Jenner, who taught the course, that she sends her warm regards to you and thanks you for taking part, because it was such a rich experience for her, and she loves the fact that we're sharing this over the airways with the community. So thank you, and great, go for it.
Hi, my name is Tui, and I'm going to read three sections from a longer essay I've written called Theme and Variations, which is about my husband and his love of pianos. The Gendered Piano. My daughter Kirsten and I were discussing whether our newly delivered Schimmel grand piano was male or female, when the piano mover opened a bag and out slid a large black shiny piece of slinky synthetic velvet with a frill around it. Whatever it was, it certainly wouldn't look out of place in a brothel, not that I've ever been in one, and the only prostitute I've known worked from her brick and tile home in North Dunedin, where I would sometimes drop off her children after school. The black slinky object turned out to be a dust cover for our piano, but I'd rather have the dust. We agreed that the rich mahogany brown Schimmel must be female. I've always regarded Maestro's pianos as female, the other women in his life who claim his affection and attention. Some languages identify a gender for a piano. In French and Italian, pianos are masculine. German and Danish regard them as gender neutral. Whereas in English, a piano, like a potlet or a piccolo, could be polygender or agender for all the guidance our language gives us. So our Schimmel is female. Maestro concurs, and since she was made in Germany, he's trying to decide if she's Frau Schimmel or Fräulein Schimmel. Mooching around central Vienna one day, trying to reconcile my imagining of the Vienna of Baroness von Schrader in the film The Sound of Music with the fast-paced 2011 reality, we happened upon the Bluthner Klavierhaus down a side street. The staff were happy for Maestro to spend as much time as he wanted trying various pianos while they chatted with delivery people outside the shop. Before long, he fell for a 7-foot Model 4 Bluthner Grand. I wandered nearby streets window shopping so he could have a good play, in between popping back to see how he was getting on. A couple of times I found him quietly groaning with pleasure to himself as he played while the shop staff continued chatting out in the street. The €85,000 price tag put it completely out of our reach, unless, of course, one day we win bonus bonds or lotto. We've had friends who've won the top prize in both, although none bought a grand piano. I'm happy for Maestro to have these other loves in his life, as long as he still wants me. After all, it's 42 years since we signed what we call the Treaty of Waikare, having married in the Waikare Hospital Chapel, and I've got very used to him being around. I've even got used to having a piano or two around. This inanimate yet demanding and at times vocal third party in our marriage has caused challenges requiring negotiation over the years to ensure we can live together as a comfortable threesome, him, me and his current piano. We've had friends try piano-less threesomes, and they have been trickier to negotiate and much less enduring. Reverie. I once asked Maestro if he would like to be a ship's doctor. Not because he had any interest in ships or travelling, he didn't, but because I thought it would be fun for me. At school in the 1960s, I had dreamt of being a ship's captain and sailing the world. I read library books about officer training, but they assumed trainees lived in England, which I didn't, could sail a yacht, which I couldn't, and were male, which I wasn't. Sailing the high seas clearly wasn't for me, which was fortunate for the world's waterways and wharves, given my problem with opposites, and lefts and rights in particular. Maestro didn't hesitate before answering that he had no interest in becoming a ship's doctor. I didn't think he would because he gets seasick and he wasn't itching to see the world and he wouldn't have his piano with him. I still had to ask. Coda. Often I go to bed at night, as now, to read or write while Maestro does his last piano practice for the day. His playing of Brahms, Beethoven, Debussy, Chopin, Gershwin and Rachmaninoff is the soundtrack to my life. I can't imagine Maestro's love affair with pianos ever ending, but I do know that one day his life will. Our family folder on Dropbox contains his funeral suggestions. As well as a request for his brother John to pay Fat Swallows Ain't Misbehaving, and a plea to ensure the church is warm enough, is a list of possible music for before and after the service. The first movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, the second movement of Beethoven's Pathetique Sonata, the second movement of Mozart's Elvira Madigan Concerto, particularly the recording he did with Kirsten on the flute. Much as he loves it, he understands that if he dies before me, I couldn't cope with having Chopin's funeral march at his funeral. I've suggested instead that someone play it the night before on his piano in our lounge with him in the open coffin amid family and friends. His suggestions conclude with his version of David Harkin's You Can Shed Tears Now She Is Gone, which ends, "And when you're ready, do what you'd want. Smile, open your eyes, love, make music, and go on."
Okay, my name is Marijke Barton, and I'm going to read two excerpts from an essay called What is My Mountain? What is my mountain? About a year after we had emigrated to New Zealand, my 6-year-old daughter came home from school and announced her homework was to write her mihi. She explained to us what a mihi was, sat down at the table, read out "My mountain is," and was just about to start writing when she looked at me and asked, "What's your mountain, Mum?" She asked this question 10 years ago. What is my mountain? I grew up in Hamburg in northern Germany and spent weekends and holidays at my grandparents' farm in Wewelsfleet, 50 kilometers away at the mouth of the Elbe, where the river joins the North Sea. This is a land so flat that wherever you turn, the green pastures stretch towards the horizon in all directions, and above it an immense sky. Birdsong only the cries of seagulls or migrating wild geese. Hamburg is a Hanseatic city, a city that in its thousand-year history had never been incorporated into a bigger entity, never been part of an earldom, a dukedom, a kingdom, but always remained the free and Hanseatic city of Hamburg. Even when Germany's many entities were united into one Germany in 1871, Hamburg kept the title of free city with the right to govern itself. An independent city breeds independent citizens, or so they say. Hamburg's port is still huge and still called das Tor zur Welt, the gateway to the world, not only due to all the cargo ships coming and going from across the globe, but also sitting at the crossroad of continental trading routes through Europe, from Stockholm to Salerno, Moscow to Madrid. A trading city rich enough to practice and expect a pragmatic tolerance. This city and northern Germany were home. They were the answer I gave when asked where I was from. But a mountain? In such a flat country, there were at best some bumps in the ground, not even deserving the word hill. The most significant were the dikes, built to keep the North Sea from flooding the low-lying land. I spent many hours as a child sitting on the dike near the farm, watching the ships on the Elbe making their way towards Hamburg, listening to the tide coming in through the reeds, and at those times the dike at Wewelsfleet was my mountain. The farm in Wewelsfleet had belonged to my family for 3 generations. If you go back any further, my ancestors are from all over the place, from places that are now in Denmark, Poland, France. I find myself with a bag of ancestor all sorts and pick and choose. The obvious choice is those ancestors from or close to the place where I grew up, and if they have some good story or reputation, even better. I long favoured the Frisians, the people, not the cattle breed, in this bag, mainly because of their hero Peder Lyng, who in his quest to remain independent from the Danish overlords drowned the Danish tax inspector in a cauldron of boiling kale, thus starting a short-lived rebellion and creating the Frisian battle cry, "Lever dood u Slav," better dead than a slave. The cauldron still appears in the Frisian coat of arms and in many wrought iron gates. With such a legend, I greedily grabbed my 1/16th of Frisian ancestry, to the exclusion of all others. Never mind the fact that I'd never lived in Friesland, though the land looks the same as behind the dike in Wewelsfleet, and I couldn't speak the language. An identity and a sense of belonging built on such random choice is the flimsiest aspect of home, and the one most open to self-deception and wishful thinking.
So there you have it, a few excerpts from the creative writing courses that we had in the summer. We're recording these today, just a few days after the dreadful attack in Christchurch, and we just want to add our voices, sending love to everybody who's suffering and hurting at this time, and through a tragedy, just to be creative, to love, to respect and hold that, and just lovely to be part of the community radio station here. Thank you.
You've been listening to I Learned to Write by Writing, brought to you by the University of Otago Summer School and Continuing Education Program. A podcast of this episode is available from oar.org.nz.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.